Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Well, today it's why you and me, two perfectly rational beings, spend our money in some irrational ways. Our guest, Martin Lindstrom,'s been called one of branding's most original thinkers. Well, he's done some original research. Lindstrom has written Biology, Truth and Lies About Why We Buy. You want to know a wine that's delicious with most of the food that we eat today and was snubbed for years? Well, it's Riesling. Josh Wesson, a wine maverick to his core, has some real finds. Next question is, what happens when a chef who stars in her restaurant kitchen is faced with feeding two toddlers in her home kitchen? It is not always the stuff of magazine covers. Then we take you to where little money gets you brilliant feasting. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's get started with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, if I gave you exact directions of how to get to Mosca's restaurant outside of New Orleans, I guarantee that maybe halfway out there, you would start thinking you somehow missed the boat, you're on the wrong road. To get out to Mosca's restaurant is one of those experiences that you are guaranteed to feel lost as you get there. And even when you get there, you think, this couldn't possibly be what is, in fact, one of the great Italian roadhouses anywhere in America. It couldn't possibly be, because it's such a gosh darn dump.
I mean, this is sort of at the back of beyond. Is that the way it works?
It's way out in the swamps. I mean, there is nothing else around it. And you drive for miles through nothingness. And the parking lot is a gravel wreck. The lighting is kind of dim. It looks like a speakeasy. And in fact, I think it was, in fact, a speakeasy. Somebody told us that Mosca's actually began as the hangout of the head of the New Orleans Mafia. And that made a whole lot about it clear, because that's exactly what it seems like.
So when someone said to you back in the day when that was the role it played, that we're going to take you out to dinner, you may never have made it to Mosca's.
I never thought of that. That's
dinner
great.
For the alligators, maybe?
Yeah.
Or something?
It's been there since 1946, and it did get battered by Katrina, but they kind of debattered it enough to open up and yet keep the...
But it still looks like an old dump.
Right.
Amazing.
But enough with the dump. Talk about the transcendent food.
Okay.
I mean, we're not sending you there because it's a dump. We're sending you there because it is probably the best Italian-American food in New Orleans.
And Lynn, I know you would love it the moment you step out of the car, not because of the atmosphere, but because of the atmosphere that you would smell. That is, of course, garlic. Everything this kitchen makes is redolent with garlic. Some has other things, like the chicken a la grande, which is one of their signature dishes, has not only garlic, but it's also just really fragrant with rosemary. And the menu warns that everything on the menu takes 50 minutes to cook. And that's true, because everything cooks long and slow. So that chicken a la grande, it comes on the bone. Mm-hmm. But it's one of those dishes that if you look at it hard, it starts sliding off the bone.
This sounds like that kind of food you used to be able to get in places, they were called red sauce restaurants.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
Or red checkered tablecloth restaurants.
Exactly, with the Chianti bottle and the candle. And the food was so good. And then we got very snobbish about Italian food.
Yes.
So do they do pasta? I mean, do they do great pasta?
The one pasta that you have to have is their spaghetti bordelaise. It's thin spaghetti noodles.
Spaghetti bordelaise?
Yes.
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 It's New Orleans. Okay.
It's simply spaghetti noodles in oil and butter and garlic. Well, that's all there is.
Tons of garlic.
But it goes so great with, the one thing that must be said is that it is in some ways one of those traditional old red sauce Italian restaurants. But this is New Orleans and this is the Gulf Coast. And therefore, the shrimp, the crab meat, they make it's a casserole.
What is this, Oysters Mosca?
The Oysters
my
Mosca.
My absolute favorite thing in the
world. Oh, my gosh. I mean, this is it's breadcrumbs. Garlic.
Freshly shucked oysters.
And lots of freshly shucked oysters. And I don't know, oil. I mean, it's just like the most oozingly delicious thing with more oysters than you can count. You know, you fork into it and get two or three oysters on the fork, and the breadcrumbs are falling off, and the oil is dripping down your chin. It's just like, oh, this is heaven. I just have to add one little side note here, is that when you're done with this super garlicky meal, you may be in the mood for a palate cleanser. And that comes in the form of Mosca's pineapple fluff, which is pineapple chunks, whipped cream, melted marshmallows, all topped with graham cracker crumbs.
Don't forget, this place was started in 1946, and I think pineapple fluff to me sounds like something they've probably had on the menu for 62 years.
Off the back of a marshmallow box, probably.
I have to tell you, though, it does sound rather tempting. I'd better quit now. Thank you, guys. Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
One of Jane and Michael Stern's life-changing tomes is Two for the Road. Now, you know the Sterns are here every week, but you don't have to wait days to get their food finds. Just check them out anytime on the website, splendidtable.org. Call Joshua Wesson a wine maverick, not out of lack of respect, but out of just the opposite. There are people in the business who get stuck in that head of, if it isn't esoteric, expensive, and hard to get, it can't be worth drinking. Josh has all the background to pass those judgments, but he came to the conclusion that wine was for everyday pleasure and good, inexpensive wine could be found. Josh, good to have you back.
Always good to be with you.
Josh, I remember a long, long time ago that one of the popular kinds of American wine were Rieslings. And you don't see them anymore. And was that because they were kind of bad, or is it just that they fell out of favor?
Well, I think that there were two forces at work that pushed Riesling down, because you're absolutely right. And before Prohibition, it was the dominant white variety in the United States. At least in the Napa Valley and up in Northern California. And it was widely grown in Michigan. It was grown in New York State. It produced wines that back then usually were on the sweet side. Mm-hmm. But I think our palates dried out after Prohibition. You know, people coming back from the Second World War were drinking European wines that were dry, and they brought back a demand for drier wines, and Rieslings kind of gave way to Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc and Cabernet Sauvignon and all the grapes that dominate today. But Riesling is absolutely on the rise again. I am so happy to say that it is one of the fastest growing grapes in terms of its planting in the United States. It still doesn't constitute a tremendously large amount of acres under cultivation, but I know that last year, Riesling sales in the United States climbed something like 30%. It was just, crazy.
That's pretty significant.
Yeah, second only to Pinot Noir.
So you're talking American Rieslings are growing that way?
Well, I mean, Riesling in general is a hot grape right now because it's been anointed by a lot of wine wags, me included, as an insanely good wine to have with food. Mm-hmm. And it just so happens that we've had a fair amount of time after Prohibition to figure out what grapes grow best in what locations. And Riesling is a grape that loves to grow in a fairly cool climate. It's true in Germany. It's true in Australia. And it's true in the United States. So we're seeing Rieslings really come to fore and express themselves deliciously in places like Oregon and Washington State and the cooler little pockets of Northern California. And one of my favorite places for Riesling is the Finger Lakes up in the northern part of New York State. Fantastic. World-class Rieslings are coming from all of those places, and I am championing them whenever I can.
Tell me some names.
Well, from the Finger Lakes, I had an amazing Riesling, an absolutely mind-blowing, life-altering, DNA-changing Riesling from Standing Stone Vineyards. It's a small winery on the Finger Lakes. And the best way, by the way, for our listeners to get these wines from New York is just to go Google Standing Stone Vineyards, and you'll get links to people who will be able to sell them and ship them to you. Mm-hmm. But for $15, a lot of New York State Rieslings have a kiss of sweetness. And that sweetness offsets the razor-like acidity that these wines have because they're grown in a cool climate. The grapes don't struggle to ripen, but they've got this lovely mouth-watering acidity. And this wine is just, to me, the very essence, the expression of all that's delicious about this grape. And it's $15. I can't recommend it highly enough. And if you can't find that, Lamoureux Landing or Lafayette Renault Riesling, also from the Finger Lakes, all about $15, are fabulous stunt doubles. But if you go over to the other side of the country, you know, there's some magical wines being made by large producers, not these tiny producers like you see in the Finger Lakes, but in Washington State. They make, you know, if not an ocean, at least a very large lake of delicious off-dry Riesling. And a producer as big as Columbia Crest, you know, makes a fantastic Riesling for $7-$8. That's very hard to beat. It's just delicious.
Am I remembering correctly, could I have had Riesling in Idaho that was really
yes.
neat?
Yes. There are many made there, probably, you know, a dozen and a half quality producers in Idaho. But the one that people are most likely to find, the most widely distributed, is also very reasonably priced. It's from Ste. Chapelle, and it is a lovely pure Riesling with a kiss of sweetness, goes for around $11 or $12, not to be confused with Ste. Michelle, which is over in Washington State. Mm-hmm. But Ste. Chapelle, fantastic wine for around $12 that goes beautifully with you know, any trout that you pull out of a stream up there. Just magnificent wine.
California-produced Rieslings you mentioned, any that from there that you recommend?
Yeah, up in Mendocino, Cole Ranch is really, really good. Mendocino is, of course, cool climate, great place to grow Riesling. And even in the Napa Valley, one of the oldest, most consistent producers of dry Riesling has been Trefethen. And their last three or four efforts have been magnificent. And it's Napa Valley, which is not exactly a cool place to grow grapes, but they managed to effect that beautiful balance of razor-like acidity and rich fruit. And the difference between Trefethen's Riesling and, let's say, the Rieslings coming from Washington State or up in the Finger Lakes is that it's made in a very dry style. In fact, it's almost Alsatian in its suggestion of dry fruit, but wonderful to drink and, of course, a wonderful food wine like so many Rieslings are.
Yeah. Hey, Josh, thank you.
My pleasure.
Josh Wesson is Senior Director of Wine, Beer, and Spirits at the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company. Now, you can find Josh's American Riesling picks and a dish to go with them, supper tart of red onion, greens, and grapes, on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to also check out our other examples of vital, essential, life-changing information. Our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, our podcasts, information on our book, How to Eat Supper, and our latest development, something we're calling Splendid Cheap Eats, a collection of inexpensive recipes culled from our archive. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Coming up, the mysterious forces that drive us to spend money and a great place for cheap eats. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Martin Lindstrom's been dubbed branding's most original thinker. He's consulted on marketing for a laundry list of food companies and other marketing groups. His latest and largest research project led him to believe that all the usual market research done to sell us stuff is dead wrong. Forget the focus groups, the taste tests, and the ads. Instead, he claims to now understand that mysterious forces drive us in ways that we never knew. Enter the spooky music. Martin Lindstrom's new book is Biology, Truth and Lies About Why We Buy. Martin, welcome.
Well, great to be on the show.
So, can you give me an example of how these mysterious forces work?
Well, certainly I can. It's interesting because some times ago we decided to do an experiment. The experiment was to spraying a smell of freshly cut grass into a do-it-yourself store. And guess what happens? First of all, the customers suddenly felt that the staff were 49% more intelligent. And not only that, people suddenly got hungry for a certain type of food when they were children, when they were basically 5 or 6 years old. So that was just the magic of a smell. And that's the reason why retailers now are starting to use the sensors in order to seduce us to buy more.
So is smell one of the strongest senses in that case? Or would it be also the sound of something or even the sense of taste?
The sense of sound is actually the most important sense. Originally, I thought it was the sense of smell, but it's not. Sound is powerful because it takes us straight back in time. So what brands are doing now is to build sounds into things. And that's the reason why when you, for example, see ads for food right now, that just by having the sizzling sound is enough to make us become hungry. Much more powerful than the sight, by the way.
Huh. Now, how did you do this testing?
Well, what we did was we conducted 2,000 scans of consumers across 5 countries. We're using a technology called fMRI, and the F stands for functional. And MRI is probably the most sophisticated brain imaging technology in the world. It costs between $5,000 and $6,000 just for one scan. We spent about $7 million scanning consumers' brains, and what we wanted to do was to find out what really goes on in our brains. Because what's so interesting is that the majority of the decisions you and I make every day, in fact, take place in the subconscious part of the brain.
So let me understand how you did this. Did you actually put people into that tube that is the MRI and then talk to them or show them pictures or what?
Yes, as you say, we put them into this tube or into this gigantic scanner, and then we exposed them for a range of different photos, for smells, for tastes, for tactile sensations. Mm-hmm. And what you have to do is to click on a little mouse to indicate when you have a certain emotional reaction. We actually do this because we want to pinpoint that track we have recorded on our computers to find out where you actually felt there was a reaction and where we could see the reaction in the brain. So what we do now is when there's a lot of blood flow going into a certain region of the brain, we know what those regions stands for, and then scientists are later on analyzing that particular region to find out what emotions typically are associated with that region.
What are the main driving forces? When we talk about senses, you're saying sound, but what are some of the other forces that drive us to buy?
Well, I think the most important thing we learned from the research study is that the concept of subliminal advertising, in fact, is much more powerful than we thought before. And we actually did an experiment where we had 2 billboards, one billboard with a cowboy, another billboard with a cowboy, but this time with a logo of a famous tobacco brand. Now, guess what? We learned that the billboard without the logo were double as powerful as the one with the logo.
Really?
And that's the first time ever we learned that the power of the logo is diminishing, and in fact the subconscious signals are now really starting to be important in order to persuade people to buy more.
You're saying that if I see a logo, it isn't as powerful as if I just see the product, a cigarette in this case, or a soft drink.
No, not only that. In fact, if you go back to soft drinks, Coca-Cola invented the glass bottle in 1915. And the original brief was to develop a bottle that if you drop it on the floor and it smashes into thousands of pieces, I can still pick up a piece of glass and recognize the brand. Now, that is the whole concept of what you will see happening in the future, that you will see a lot of indirect signals. That means a shape, a tactile sensation, a color, a sound, a smell, which are telling the story about the brand.
So can we control this uncontrollable collection of reactions? I mean, how can we resist buying?
Well, what's interesting is that we know from our studies that if you and I as consumers are aware of that this goes on, we're actually not seduced. So that's the good news. But let me just give you a free quick advice, which you know, you should have in mind when you go out and shopping next time, Lynn. The first thing is never be hungry. When you're hungry and you go out buying stuff, you're not only buying more food, you actually buy more everything. So don't be hungry. The second thing is don't be seduced by word games. We actually did an experiment in a supermarket in Europe where we did a pile of cans of soups. They were just piled up in a little tower, and we added a price tag on top of the tower saying $1.95 for a can of soup. No one took anything.
Mm-hmm.
Then the day after, we added a little tagline saying maximum 8 cans of soup per customer. Guess what happened? People were rushing to the counter. They took all those cans of soup, and it was sold out in hours. And that is the second trick retailers are using. They're saying $9.95. Well, we think it's $9. It is actually $10. So don't be seduced by those word games out there. And the last piece of advice to you should be never to grab that trolley or that basket when you're going to the supermarket, because we actually know that the size of the basket is indicating how much you're prepared to buy. And actually, recent experiments we conducted shows that if the size of the basket is double of what it normally was, you actually buy 30% more products. So my advice to you is don't grab it, hold the stuff in your hands instead.
I see myself doing a juggling act, but I think it will help. Martin, thank you.
Pleasure.
Martin Lindstrom is author of Biology, Truth and Lies About Why We Buy. In 1999, laid-back chef and writer Gabrielle Hamilton rented a little storefront in Manhattan's East Village. She crowded together some tables and started to cook to please herself. Well, for this fancy food city, this was the least fancy food that you could imagine. Deviled eggs, bacon and marmalade sandwiches, roasted marrow bones, big flavors, lots of satisfaction. Well, you know the rest. Her restaurant Prune was a huge hit, awards were racked up, and then the babies came. Now the professional chef cooks for two audiences, and I'd like to know which one's tougher. Gabrielle Hamilton, welcome.
Thank you.
So how are you adapting to cooking for little people?
Oh, my little kids.
Yeah.
My little crumb snatchers. Yeah, unfortunately, I'm adapting and they're not. So it's pretty boring. In fact, we almost cook exclusively plain buttered pasta. And that's what I eat now, too, at home, which is my least favorite idea of a meal.
Well, you know, you realize you're not the first woman who's dealt with this now.
No, I know. But isn't there that idea like, oh, children of a chef, they must be eating such extraordinary food. And in fact... They're not and I'm not until I go to work. And thank God. Now I really, really love to go to work because there's more complicated ingredients in the walk-in and I can put spice in things. And
so you're not doing the short order cook thing then where you cook one meal for you and your husband and one
Hell no. So funny when I was pregnant in the beginning and people would say to me sort of mockingly or derisively, like, oh, are you going to be one of those women that makes your own baby food? And I felt like, I guess the correct answer is no, of course not. I would never do that. But of course, it's so easy. You just boil water and put the vegetable in it and then mash it up with a fork. And if that seems complicated to people, the same people that go on to make, as you just said, short order cooking, like one meal for themselves, one meal for the husband, I have never understood the discrepancy between those two attitudes.
So just talking about what you do, I mean, what you spend 18 hours a day doing is running Prune, the restaurant.
Yeah.
And Prune made its name with, for lack of a better word, home cooking. I mean, you were using the low-end cuts, the kind of food that a lot of people called humble. But now we're all in a state where we're looking at that kind of food. Mm. Mm-hmm. So what has this changed the way you're working in the restaurant at all?
Home cooking. That is true. That is exactly what I had wanted to have when we opened the restaurant. It's supposed to be home cooking, except prepared by people who really know how to cook. Because, you know, sometimes your mom's cooking is uneven.
Yeah. Yeah.
It looks like home cooking, but it's really prepared by people who know what they're doing.
Yeah.
So there was that. And we did start out with a lot of things that I grew up eating in my home as a child. So that was offals and innards and low cuts, that's which is actually not comfort food in any way. And frequently I noticed we would in reviews, people would refer to the food at Prune as comfort food, which I always thought was code for sort of anti-female chef, as if the only thing a woman chef can produce is comfort food. It was
yeah.
very strange.
Interesting.
Thought,
yeah.
What
but
do
a good
you find
point.
Comforting about marrow bones? I can't think of anything more challenging texturally and visually.
But how has it changed?
So now we're noticing that those low cuts have become the prima ballerinas of the dance. In fact, you can't swing a dead cat in this town without hitting sweetbreads on any menu, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere
mm-hmm.
you go, it's pork jowl and a whole head of pig boiled, and you eat the whole thing at the table, and that is now good luck finding filet mignon or loin of anything. It's incredible. The hoof and the tail and the nose have taken center stage. And those things are more expensive now, too. We were noticing that for years I have had a prime dry-aged ribeye on the menu since mm-hmm. we opened. And I've never been able to afford it. We don't have foie gras. We don't have truffles.
Yeah,
No caviar, nothing like that. We certainly could not afford that meat. But I've always subsidized it with the sale of marrow bones, which, of course, your butcher used to give you for your dog.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they were practically free, and they were 35 cents, and they paid for the ribeye for years. And now the marrow bones are, you know, $4 a pound, or the sweetbreads, which used to be 2¼ a pound, are now $6.75 a pound. So, in fact, I'm not even charging enough for the low cuts that have financed us for years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't quite understand the obsession with pork. I actually am starting to measure the sign of a less than adequate cook by how much pork they have on their menu, because it's the home run. It's the
mm-hmm.
It's like the white truffle oil. You sprinkle a little of that on, and everyone's like, oh, swooning. And the pork belly, of course, is incredibly flavorful. And I think, actually, it's a lot harder to cook a loin, actually, or,
yeah.
you know, because you have to get
uh-huh.
the temperature right, uh-huh. or crudo. Everyone has raw fish. Crudo, ceviche, raw
mm-hmm.
fish with a little
mm-hmm.
oil. I think, well, and yeah, because it's harder to cook a piece of fish.
Absolutely is. Hey, Gabrielle, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Gabrielle Hamilton is chef owner of the restaurant Prune in New York City. Now, for a dish that we think the little ones might like, check out Toddler's Soft Scrambled Eggs and Peas Tossed with Pasta and Mozzarella Bites. That's a taller title than most of the toddlers. Anyway, it's on the website, splendidtable.org. Find yourself in Portland, Oregon, you absolutely have to check out the street food. I don't think any other city in the country could top it. Portland's downtown is jammed with food carts. They cluster on squares and malls. Now, these are small businesses where for a few bucks, you can have lunch or dinner in just about any culinary language you'd want. In fact, every year, the Vendy Awards pick the stars. Well, we got a hold of Martha Holmberg. She's food editor of Portland's Oregonian newspaper. We asked her to be our guide just before the lunch crowd hit.
Now, where are we heading?
We are heading to one of the clusters. There are several clusters. They're like springing up like moss on a Portland roof around the city. And we're going to Southwest 9th and Alder, which is right near downtown.
Right.
One of the places I want to take you to today is this cute little kind of cupcake pastry shop. This young girl, she's been a pastry chef at restaurants around town, doesn't really want to start her, you know, a whole restaurant or a big thing with a lot of investment, so she's starting out in a cart, and it's fantastic.
What a great way to begin a business. Now, a lot of the ones I've seen are ethnic carts, you know, Peruvian and Chinese and this kind of thing.
You are seeing really interesting things. Another place I want to go today is a Bosnian, you know, the familiar Bosnian cuisine that we always go out and
get. Yes, exactly.
Let's go get Bosnian. So, you know, there's lots of Indian and sort of offshoots. I think there's uh-huh. a West African place.
Great. Let's get out. Okay. I'm going to head across the street.
Let's see. I got to put a parking. Oh.
Uh-oh. Sugar Cube's not here. She's sick.
Sorry for the inconvenience, but I am a one-woman show.
But, yeah, here's what I wanted you to have, the cupcakes. Amy Winehouse.
I love it. This is the Amy Winehouse cupcake. Boozy yellow cake with a hint of orange zest. I love this. Dipped in sexy chocolate ganache. And then in big letters, you need.
And you know what it is? It's a Harvey Wallbanger cake. You know, isn't that
a thing? Oh, yes, I remember. Yeah.
It's her take on the Harvey Wallbanger.
That's our grandmother's, for gosh sakes.
I mean, and I love this Guinness.
My goodness.
It's a basically a ginger cupcake, really gingery, but it's really moist and deep with Guinness, and it has a maple cream cheese frosting.
You know, the woman has a sense of humor. I gotta love her.
The stuff's great.
Okay, so what else is here? I mean, now I'm hungry.
Yeah. Come around the corner. We'll see what Sika's doing.
Okay.
That's the Bosnian place, which when I first saw it, it's like Zeba's pitas. Okay, great. I'll get a little pita sandwich. Well, she uses the word pita to mean something completely different and incredibly flaky, and hopefully she can explain how she rolls it out herself.
Now, we've walked past, just in these few seconds, Mexico, Peru, and coffee.
Hello. Oh. Hello. How are you?
Hello. You must be Zeba.
Yes, I'm Zeba.
I'm Lynn. Hello.
Nice to meet you.
This doesn't look like pita. This looks like pastry.
I have different kinds of pita. I have meat.
Uh-huh.
Number one, cheese. Number two.
Right.
Zucchini, spinach pita.
Right.
And chufta is not pita, but it's Bosnian food.
In the spirit of research, could we have one of each?
Sure.
I make three plates.
Okay.
And I put everything what I have here. Very easy.
That'd be great.
Okay. Take a place.
You know, this is pretty. Look at this. Blue metal table.
And these are the things I love. See this? I mean, talk about gorgeous. This bright red. It's like a red pepper puree.
Right.
Kind of thing.
And then chunks of cucumber and drizzled with this white sauce.
With yogurt. It's that thick, thick, really creamy yogurt.
Oh, my. Crisp cucumber. And the red pepper is really sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, the yogurt is almost like sour cream.
And these pastries, as you can see, are really rich. And so this salad-y stuff is the perfect complement.
Oh, this now, is
I like
not... I mean, she's rolling this. This is like eating phyllo.
She rolls out super thin dough, like phyllo. But I'm sure she does it sort of in big sheets, more like
right.
a strudel dough. It's almost like looks like a Danish pastry sort of thing.
Oh, this is so delicious.
Oh.
Buttery.
Oh.
Chewy. Crisp.
Mm.
And I've just tasted the cheese.
I love the cheese. I don't know what the cheese is in it. It's tangy
like
and creamy.
Fresh farm cheese, but more tangy
a
than
a little
that.
Feta-ish.
Yeah. Right now the spinach. I would eat this every day.
I love the spinach. It's unbelievable.
Oh, the meat is fabulous too.
Ooh, and taste the cream that's on the meatballs.
Great seasoning, but you're right. That sauce, it's tangy, it's soury. I meant what I said. If I lived here, I'd be eating this every other day. Martha, thanks so much for the light lunch, dear, and for the tour.
My pleasure.
Martha Holmberg is food editor of the Oregonian newspaper in Portland, Oregon. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what might a lamb be able to do to surpass a car? We're going to be back with that answer in a moment, and we will be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. We're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what might a lamb be able to do to surpass a car? Well, the answer is belch. Recently, the Wall Street Journal reported that researchers now believe livestock industries could be producing more methane gases, that's greenhouse gases, than cars do. Therefore, the animals contribute more to global warming. It's all in the emissions of a bodily sort. Sheep belching is being researched in New Zealand. This business of the burp is pretty challenging. Grass eaters with multiple stomachs, we're talking sheep, goats, and cows, generate more methane gas. Tests with new feeds have failed, and not every livestock rancher is buying into the belch theory. Yet, if this theory proves out, will we be seeing the gene pool for these animals reduced down to nothing? I mean, it's really hard to believe that a pasture of fluffy white creatures does more harm than that brown cloud from downtown traffic. The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything you want to talk about? Okay, let's see who is on the line. We have got Frank calling from Kingsport, Tennessee. Hey, Frank, what do you want to talk about?
Well, Lynn, I'd like to get some ideas about steaming vegetables. I've been retired for 22 years, and just my wife and myself, and I do the cooking as sort of a hobby. I'm not making any claims for fame here. But I thought steaming vegetables would leave the nutrients in and might taste good. And Brussels sprouts and cauliflower, the only two things that I've really tried, have marvelous flavor when steamed.
You know, it's an amazing thing that steaming does things to vegetables. It seems to... I can't quite explain. It seems to almost compress flavors, doesn't it? They taste.
Yes, it does.
They taste more of themselves. Yeah. So you're saying, what else can you steam?
Yeah. What else can I steam? And how can I get salt into it?
Well, you know what you can do is just sprinkle a little bit of salt onto the vegetables when you put them in the steamer.
Okay. When you put it into the steamer.
Yeah.
All
it's
right.
That simple, and you don't need a lot, but it'll be actually steamed into the veggies, and a little goes a very long way when you do that. And by the way, you could put herbs in.
Yeah.
And by the way,
would you put the herbs in the water?
No, put them right in the vegetables.
Just right on the vegetables.
Right on the vegetables. Yeah. And
okay.
And then you'll when you taste them, you'll think, "Dad, the next time I want more." Or I think I'll use a little more of this or a little less of that. And the
right.
other thing is, just as an aside, save the water because that has a lot of nutrients. It tastes great, and it's a great thing to make vegetable soup with. But let's say you can steam almost any vegetable. You could steam sliced up artichokes. You can steam carrots, broccoli, green beans, asparagus. You can steam sliced turnips, rutabaga. You could steam chunks of sweet potato. Now, things that are really, really hard, like a carrot,
right.
take a longer time. So there's where if you cut them thin, they steam faster. It's just, you know, it's logical. The,
sure.
the thinner the piece, the faster it's going to go. So almost any vegetable, and you know what's really interesting to do, is to take greens, tender greens like Swiss chard or spinach or even romaine that you might use for salad.
Oh, yeah.
And lightly wilt it in the steamer with a little salt and then pull it out and just put a little oil and vinegar on it.
Oil and vinegar.
And it turns into something very different. It's just delicious. But think about, I mean, you really seriously can steam almost any vegetable that you're drawn to.
Now, how about other things? Meat, is that a no-no?
Well, no. You know, the only thing with steaming things like the fish steams beautifully. I mean, you could lay out whole shrimp in there and steam them.
But the
thing is, you want to watch it really, really, really closely because, you know, it can go very quickly. And with shrimp, you know, if you overcook them, you've got rubber. And better to undercook slightly than overcook because with the heat it maintains, it'll finish cooking. And you will get this pure, delicate, subtle flavor.
Well, that's great.
So you
that's
can,
great. Well, that gives me a whole lot of ideas. I can pursue my hobby a little bit further.
You sure can. Thanks for a great question, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate your answers. I've got all kinds of ideas now. And thank you very much, Lynn.
You take care, Frank.
Good.
Bye. Bye. Call us, 800-537-5252. We've got Carl on the line calling from Minneapolis. Carl, what do you want to talk about?
I have a turkey question.
Turkey?
Yes.
Hey,
yes.
I haven't gotten a turkey question, well, since November.
Well,
lay it on me.
Okay. Well, my domestic partner just loves roasting turkey. And we host Thanksgiving dinner at our house every year and have a lot of fun with that.
Uh-huh.
Part of the fun is listening to you when we're cooking.
Thank you.
But once a year is not enough for him for roasting a turkey.
He shares this with my husband, by the way.
Okay. So several weeks back, I think it was right after Christmas, we were in the grocery store, and he persuaded me that we just had to buy a 12-pound frozen turkey. So this frozen turkey has been sitting in our freezer for several weeks now, but where I'm kind of hung up is, for me, roast turkey is just so strongly associated with the traditional Thanksgiving menu.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't quite get my head around how we do a dinner, invite some people over, create a nice menu that doesn't seem like we're trying to recreate Thanksgiving in late winter or early spring.
Well, I think the simplest, and you want to roast it as opposed to stew it or whatever, right?
Yeah, it's definitely roasting. Yeah.
Okay. This is the deal. I think you just switch the seasonings. You do something with it that normally isn't necessarily associated with that turkey. So one of the things you could do, do you ever brine your birds?
We have not tried that.
I mean, you don't have to, but brining, the lovely thing about brining is it's an insurance policy. Because the brine permeates the actual meat of the bird, and it plumps it and it moistens it. And what I'm thinking is that if you were to do an Asian-style brine, okay, so this would be it's a 12-pound turkey?
Yes.
Okay, you'd need a container that you could submerge the turkey in and keep it cold.
Sure.
So so here's the deal. You would might do a cup of something like kosher salt, a cup of, or let's say about two-thirds a cup of brown sugar. You'd want about four heads of garlic that you just smashed the you-know-what out of. Okay, mix that together. You'd probably want about 2 gallons of water.
Okay.
And if you wanted to, you could puree into that a whole bunch of ginger. But since ginger is really expensive, hold off because the ginger will come into this later.
Sure.
All right. So the thing and I would throw about a half a cup of soy sauce into that mix.
Okay.
And the idea is submerge the bird in that overnight. Keep it cold. It's got to be cold. Keep that cold. You pull it out, and then I would do a puree of ginger, fresh ginger, and garlic. Do you guys like hot food? Spicy?
Well, we're both Norwegian, so we have our limits.
I get it. Okay. Yeah. All right. So garlic and ginger is going to go with mixed with a bit of soy, not too much, all right, and some rice vinegar, of all things.
Sure.
All right? You're going to puree that up, and you're going to stuff that under the skin.
Mm.
And that is going to be the main part of your flavoring. And then you're going to slow roast the bird, and you could butterfly it if you wanted to. Okay? And by the way, if you wanted to do a little coriander, fresh coriander in that mix and puree that in,
sure,
or onion or scallion, you could do that. So that all goes under the skin. And now what you're going to do is you're going to baste it with a little bit of white wine. And toward the end of cooking, you're going to baste it with a combination of a little white wine with brown sugar.
Okay.
So you get a sweet tart, and then I would serve it on a bed of some fresh coriander. You could have a rice noodle salad with that, with maybe some fresh pineapple chopped into it or mango. And then I would squeeze fresh lime juice over that whole turkey as you serve it hot.
Mm, okay.
And I think that might be interesting for you.
Well, this would be fun. I never would have thought of going the kind of Asian flavoring through.
Yeah, and I would have done even like a teriyaki. But if you put anything that's very sweet under that skin for the roasting, it's going to burn. That's why anything sweet's going to go on toward the end.
Sure.
So try that. I mean, it's loose. Obviously, this isn't written in stone. But go the Asian route. Nobody expects it. But anything you can do with an Asian chicken or pork or whatever, you can flavor the turkey.
Right. Great.
Hey, have fun.
Will do.
And if you have any leftovers, let me know.
Okay, I will.
Take care, Carl.
Thanks, Lynn.
Bye. 800-537-5252. You can't find the hottest new cooking tool on the equipment sites, nor can Williams-Sonoma get you one, but New York Times reporter Julia Moskin can hook you up. Hey, Julia, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
Now, look, I know you have been digging around the culinary marketplace, so what have you found?
Well, one thing that we were really noticing as people started to get iPhones is that people really were using them in a new way. There are some other devices that have those capabilities, the internet search and recipe applications, but it's really the iPhone that has kind of put it together in a new way where people are really using their phones as tools in the kitchen.
So in what way?
Well, the photography aspect of it is really important. The ability to send photographs back and forth for home cooks, I found especially with novices that they love to use it while they're cooking to send photographs, especially to their mothers. Emailing pictures to mom came up quite a bit where they say, is this what this lasagna topping is supposed to look like? Or is this crust what you mean when you say golden brown, which is really a fabulous resource that, you know, most of us didn't have when we were learning to cook.
I think that's great. So other than novice cooks, I mean, I can imagine you're shopping, you see something on sale, you thumb through, you find a recipe.
Sure. I mean, being able to find recipes is, we're just really at the beginning of that. I mean, imagine maybe 1996 when these online recipe databases started coming around and people thought, is this the end of the cookbook? Is this going to transform the way people interact with recipes and cookbooks? And in a way, it has. But we're really at the beginning of that. But it really makes a huge difference, not so much for novice cooks, but especially for people who are trying to shop on the way home from work, for example, which is one of the biggest challenges that mm-hmm. we hear, you mm-hmm. know, from our readers. That it's not so much the cooking on the weeknights, it's the planning and the shopping and the cooking. And it really helps with shopping. There are a lot of list-making capabilities, and there are also more and more recipe databases that you can access through your phone, such as Big Oven, which has 167,000 recipes. Now, the quality of those recipes, you know, whether they're tested, whether they work, that all remains to be figured out. But the fact remains, they're all there, and you can look at them on your phone. One of the first online food websites, the Kraft website, which is extremely popular, has just come out with an application for the iPhone, and it's really very efficient. Now, of course, it's great for Kraft because it uses mm-hmm. the iPhone's GPS positioning. So they can not only you can not only go on and look up a Kraft recipe, but you can also be told where the nearest supermarket is, and they can guide you step by step to buying all the relevant Velveeta cheese that you might need. So
this is definitely
the manufacturers are seeing this as a wave of the future that they want to take advantage of.
Big Brother is telling you exactly where to shop and what aisle to go down. But what about professional chefs? Are they using it?
They use it in really interesting ways. You know, for them, the visual aspect of cooking is really important, and so they use it constantly to record dishes, even if it's just like a fabulous fish taco that they're having at a taco truck, just so that they can remember all of the elements, like, oh, that is what that, you know, chili mayonnaise looked like. Oh, mm-hmm. they used cabbage instead of lettuce, the kind of thing that takes a long time to take notes. They can just get that down and photograph things, email it to themselves. Another way that they use it now is in the kitchens of large restaurants like Tabla, for example, in New York, which mm-hmm. is a restaurant that has three kitchens and about 40 cooks working at once. And the chef there is a very polite and soft-spoken guy called Floyd Cardoz, and he's not a yeller, unlike most chefs. And he has mandated a policy wherein everyone who works in the kitchen has to check their email right before the shift, during the shift, and at the end of the shift to see if there's anything that he's communicated in terms of how the dishes are going. He cited an example of, you know, if he sees someone putting the duck breast in on the wrong side down. Now, a lot of chefs would just shout that out.
Right.
Instead, he sends everyone an email. And he says it makes for a much more peaceful kitchen.
Well, all right. But now the big question, is the cookbook dead? Is the cooking class dead?
Well, it is interesting. I mean, the authority of people like you and me and all authors of cookbook is very much undermined by the internet, which really goes on a crowdsourcing model. And I found recipes online that had been tested and made by more than 3,000 people. On allrecipes.com. They have thousands of members, and the members write in and rate the recipes. Now, that's a very powerful amount of feedback and a lot of testing. As you and I know, cookbooks are not necessarily tested to that extent. So there's the authority of the experts that is now coming up against the authority of the crowd. We'll see who wins out.
Hey, Julia, thank you.
Oh, not at all. Thank you.
New York Times reporter Julia Moskin's article, Top Kitchen Toy, The Cell Phone, appeared in the January 21st, 2009 issue of the paper. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this from actress Natalie Portman. She said, "I'm always on the phone because I'm usually not with the people I want to be with." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media, presenting Repossessing Virtue, fresh thinking on the moral, spiritual, and ethical aspects of the economic downturn. Gain perspective at speakingoffaith.org. You'll find information on almost everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. And there's more. Not only will you find newsletters and podcasts, you'll find information in our book, How to Eat Supper. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher and Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We'll be back next week. You have a good one, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.